Tonight on Arena, actor Alex Jennings on Mobland playing Royals and performing Beckett in Enniskillen and celebrating 30 years of Muriel's Wedding. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. And it is great to be back in the arena seat. My thanks to Kay Sheehy and the entire arena team for stepping into the breach in a totally unexpected way about 6 or 7 weeks ago and for looking after things in the meantime. The Happy Days Enniskillen Festival celebrates the town's literary connection with Samuel Beckett and Oscar Wilde. It returns with a new programme called Oh My Goddo to celebrate Beckett's birthday on April the 13th. Festival highlights include a 32-piece giant sculpted chess set featuring characters from Waiting for Godot, two theatrical performed readings of the play in secret locations, although I think I'm going to give away one of those secrets tonight. One of the actors taking part in these readings is Alex Jennings. The Olivia Award-winning actor can currently be seen opposite Pierce Brosnan and Helen Mirren in Paramount's Mobland, where he plays mob boss Brosnan's best friend Archie. In Enniskillen, he will be Vladimir to Malcolm Sinclair's Estragon in Waiting for God, and delighted to be joined on the line this evening by Alex Jennings. Even as I list off just those couple of things, being the Beckett and Mobland, Alex, it kind of shows me, did I mention playing Royals, which you seem to have kind of got onto a specialised part of your acting career? Go ahead.
Hi, Sean. I've done quite a few members of the Royal Family, haven't I? And the call to be in Guy Ritchie World was something of a surprise, but I was delighted because I was able to sort of revisit my Essex roots.
I was going to ask you, was it harder to find your inner mobster than it was to find your inner royal?
I think it probably was, actually. It's such a long time since I've kind of revisited that, but that is, you know, I'm not a posh boy, but I seem to have spent my career playing them, and now sort of members of the establishment, barristers and leading gynecologists and judges and people. It was a surprise to be asked by Guy, and it was a delight. It was great to get my Essex vowels out.
get them back into full action, as it were. Let's listen to you in action with the aforementioned Conrad, played by Pierce Brosnan, and Archie, your character, Alex, your old pals, although in the mob world, I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. They find themselves back in the kitchen of Conrad's house, and they're taking off Archie's wellies the way you would, and then they start to talk future plans.
That's an awful lot of work for not a lot of fish.
Yeah, I agree. It's a bit of a disappointment. A gentleman never pours salt into the wound. Where are we with the twins?
Stalemate. Lawyers can't shift it an inch.
Have you ever known a lawyer who didn't like talking to another lawyer when he's on the clock?
Yeah.
Offer them 80% plus 20% of the commercial rental value for two years.
But the Maltese made an offer on heroin, 20% up on our dear departed friends.
Bingo! There you have it now. I told you that was good business. I won 25% and 10 million up front. Spread 5 million around Hackney. The other 5 million can go to the Mexicans. You got to make a move on this fentanyl now.
Fentanyl? Well, Richie won't be happy.
Well, you leave Richie Stevenson to me now.
Yeah, well, we don't want to start a war with the Stevens.
Why not? Come on now, Archie. We're on a roll. Why stop when you can carry on?
There we have it. Pierce Brosnan as Conrad and Alex Jennings as Archie in the opening episode of Mobland, the Guy Ritchie project currently on Paramount. I think it is currently showing. How much can you talk about poor old Alex, or not poor old Alex, poor old Archie, who's so out of his depth in that bundle of hoodlums that he lets himself in with? That's Pierce Brosnan. Helen Mirren isn't much better, let's face it, in terms of her character and how she thinks of Archie.
I can't give anything away.
I thought you mightn't.
I can't. No spoiler alerts.
Yeah, well, but it's, no spoiler alerts necessary, yeah, because there will be no spoilers.
He's in out of his depth, but he's kind of been inextricably linked with Pierce's character since they were kids together.
There's a long history there.
Yeah,
you mentioned, Alex, this idea of getting back to the Essex roots, and I even felt, even as I was listening to that short scene of a minute and 6 seconds, felt even as you got further and further into it, boy, you were enjoying chewing those Essex vowels and getting them out there.
I was, and Guy was very encouraging, and Pierce and I shot both our first scenes together on the same day. So it's a funny thing that you have to kind of dive in, no rehearsal. I'd never met Pierce before, and you hopefully form a bond of trust, which we kind of did. But you have to, take a plunge, and he was fantastic to work with, really great to work with, as was Helen, who I had last worked with when we played the Queen Elizabeth, and as he was then Prince Charles in the film The Queen. So a very different relationship. A
totally different relationship, quite definitely, between Helen Mirren and yourself in The Queen than there is in this particular, in Mobland. I sometimes I even wonder about asking actors this, because it's what you do, effectively. You try to, in as much as you can, become or convince us, the watchers, whether that's in the theatre or on the screen, that you are that person that is standing on the stage or walking across the screen in front of us. Was it a bigger stretch to, particularly in the case of Prince Charles and the Queen, where you're talking about a real person, and in that case, a living person, Edward the Eighth in The Crown, and not a living person, but nevertheless one with a lot of historical baggage around him, that you had to carry that with you as well. Is it a very different prospect when you're in that real world, I suppose, quite posh real world, as opposed to the frighteningly real world of Mobland?
Yeah, it is different, and there's a kind of different responsibility, I think, when you're playing a person, a real person, dead or alive. But you've got, you do your research and you try to, suggest the character without getting bogged down in sort of impersonation as such. And with playing the Duke of Windsor, there wasn't that much footage of him that I could watch, but lots of photographic records, and I read a huge amount about him and became slightly obsessed with the way he dressed. So that was an amazing kind of project to be a part of. And the resources were extraordinary at the start. I was in the first two seasons, and then a brief flashback appearance in season 5.
And had the resources changed from seasons 1 and 2 to seasons 5? Because, it was a big hit in seasons 1 and 2, but it really had grown into, the must-see series.
Yeah, from the start, you felt there was a lot of cash floating around. The costume budget and the production budget were pretty phenomenal, and it felt like you were making a movie, not making a TV series. So that you felt like you were in something kind of special, and with a lot of investment in it from the start, which was 8-9 years ago now.
Yeah.
when we started shooting it.
And then I think of that, and those high end costume dramas, really, in some ways, particularly in the case of The Crown. Then you look at something like The Lady in the Van, which I'm sure wasn't made on nothing, but it was a very different type of feel, I would guess, on that set. Of course, it's based on the Alan Bennett story and starred the wonderful Maggie Smith.
Yeah, and I played Alan Bennett, who I had known for some time, and I'd played him on stage, not in The Lady in the Van, but in a short play that he wrote. And that sort of gave Nick Heitner, who's a director that I've worked with a lot, the sort of the impetus to think they could make a film of The Lady in the Van, where there are two sort of Alan Bennetts, Alan Bennett the writer and Alan Bennett the person living the life of Alan Bennett and engaging with The Lady in the Van. And we filmed it in Alan's house in Camden. So that was, you know, a real kind of advantage to, and the lady's van was back in the driveway. Yeah, it was remarkable to be able to do that rather than film it on a set. And Maggie and I both knew Alan, had known Alan for a long time and knew about The Lady in the Van. I think Maggie had been to the house when she was there in the driveway. And we could see, it was kind of impossible to understand really how he let it go on for as long as he did. It's an extraordinary story. And would never kind of have it that it was out of the goodness of his heart. But there was a part of that, I think, and also partly he was aware that here was a kind of rich seam of material that he could draw on. Working with Maggie, I'd worked with Maggie on stage and the importance of being earnest. Mm. And it was a huge privilege to be around her and see her working.
Yeah, and I believe she's one of those actors who, you know, of course you see her on screen and again or on stage as the viewer and you think, oh, she must be so full of confidence to just stand up there and do that on the stage or to, you know, be able to do that type of very fine, subtle acting that you can do and kill with a look or a slight snarl of one part of her lip, which she seemed to be able to do in various characters. But I believe she became a friend of yours and perhaps Maggie Smith person is a very different being from Maggie Smith actor.
Yeah, and I think, full of vulnerabilities. I think she was a sort of cup half empty person. Life was sort of a puzzle to her in many ways, I think. But, you know, an extraordinary talent and much, you know, most actors, you know, feel that about her, that she was like the best. But she was full of, you know, when she was working, she was full of insecurity and she was her harshest critic. She delighted in it as well. She loved the invention of it and took great delight when she sort of stumbled upon something.
Now, there we are again, having touched on, you know, some elements of your career. We haven't mentioned it. It's a triple Olivier Award winning, I think I should have said in my introduction, potentially. So what part?
They were a long time ago.
Yeah, but nevertheless, they're yours and you won them.
They are.
You know, so let's not knock that. What part, or can you even think about what part of your career or your I don't like to say a bag of tricks, it's not, but your coterie of characters, where will you dip into, do you think, to find Vladimir in Godot, which is, you know, fundamental piece in terms of 20th century world theatre and a character who could be anything, you know, from a pauper to a king?
Yeah, he could be. And I played him in 1976 at the University of Warwick when I was an undergraduate. So I think I should be bringing my bowler hat with me to Ireland because I've still got it. I also did Endgame at university, but I've never done any Beckett professionally. And Sean Duran runs this amazing festival. And a few years ago, I took part in the Brian Friel Festival where we did sort of site-specific reading performance of Faith Healer, and that was such an amazing experience that when he asked me to do this, it's kind of mad, you know, four actors and a boy actor will meet on a secret location somewhere, and the audience will walk to this location and will sit down and see us do Waiting for Godot, and we're not rehearsing it. I'm doing it with a friend of mine called actor called Malcolm Sinclair. We last appeared together as Henry Higgins and Colonel Pickering in My Fair Lady at the Theatre Royal Drury Lane.
One of your Olivier Award winners, wasn't it?
It was, thank you very much. So I think we'll be quite elegant tramp. I don't know what we're going to do, really. But it's a brilliant opportunity and such a wild and crazy way to approach, you know, this extraordinary seminal play.
And I hope I'm not being nationalistic or in any way narrow-minded when I ask this question. It's yourself and Malcolm, as you said, playing Vladimir and Estragon, two English actors, obviously. Lorcan Cranach will be playing Pozzo. I think Lucky will be revealed on the day, but it will be an Irish actor, is my understanding.
Yeah.
Do you think that kind of, I mean, we're kind of old friends and old neighbours, and like the way old neighbours, we do have the odd little barney about certain things between us. But do you think those two, that Irish-English quality will bring something to the play? Have you thought much about that?
I think it will. I don't know what it will bring, but I'm sure it will kind of in the moment, in the way that we sort of respond to each other and the way that we sound and the way we approach the language. I mean, I've got a bit of Irish in me on both sides, but, you know, a few generations back, so I'm just out of reach of my Irish passport. It's a leap of faith, and for us and the audience to sort of see what happens on the day, whether the sun shines, whether it's raining when we're doing it.
Yeah, I'm in two minds. I don't know whether you're avoiding the secret location or whether I can say that secret location. Or
it's well, you might. I don't know whether we've got to keep it secret. Well, we don't want to keep it too secret, otherwise people won't come.
No. I will say there are some wonderful caves quite close to Enniskillen. That location in and of itself makes me excited to think of this kind of post-World War II play in essentially a cavernous space. It's quite exciting.
And isn't there a famous person sculpture as well related to Waiting for Godot?
There is indeed. There's a huge, big. It's a Marble Arch caves. Let me just say it straight out at that point. And it has to do with this 32 piece chess set, isn't it? That the sculpture that is there feeds into that.
You know more than I do.
You mentioned the Freel aspect of things, and you played it was Teddy in Faith Healer in Donegal in 2018. You travelled around from parish hall and local church halls to church halls to do that particular piece, which in some ways echoes the play. That must have the nature of the play being, you know, the three of them, this story being told about three people who did travel around in this kind of faith healing act in the past. That must have had a certain resonance to it when you actually went to those places.
Oh, it really did. And the audience were bused to these different locations. Lorcan Cranach was playing the faith healer, and Tamsin Gregg and myself were Teddy and Frank's wife, whose name I can't remember, and so we could also see what our fellow actors are doing. And you'd be waiting in this, as I was waiting in a church hall somewhere, and I'd see the bus with the audience turn up in the car park, and they would then sit and experience play for the audience. It lasted for hours because they were being trucked and bussed from location to location.
Yeah, exciting stuff indeed. Grace being the wife, and Hardy, of course, being Grace, the Lorcan Cranach character that you were talking about. Briefly, two final things. You've just worked with Colin Farrell in a film by Ed Berger, the director of Conclave. Can you tell me much?
It's based on a book by Lawrence Osborne, The Ballad of a Small Player, and it's Colin and Tilda Swinton and supporting folk, including me. It's about high-end gamblers. You know, the novel is there, so it's no secrets. And we filmed it in Macau, where it's set. Edward Berger, who did All Quiet on the Western Front and Conclave, remarkable director. And working with Colin was a real treat and a highlight for me. I mean, I've always been a fan of him as an actor. He's an amazing actor. And the loveliest person. I mean, remarkable.
Yeah,
really.
He seems to be a remarkable man.
Never mind, special.
The actor. And Benicio del Toro's butler, you just played in Wes Anderson's The Phoenician Scheme. Wes Anderson. I mean, you really are going through the directors at great speed and with great success.
It was quite a good, you know, and I'm kind of set dressing in Wes's film, but I was very happy to do it, and it's full of Wes Anderson all-stars. And we filmed it just outside in the studios in Potsdam. And he's quite something to work with. And the visuals and the costumes and the production design on that are something to behold. And again, yeah, I'm really lucky, you know, but Benicio was a joy to work with.
Yeah. Well, listen,
Benicio, like my friend.
You know. Yeah, your old pal.
Yeah.
But I suppose people do become friends. That's what happens.
Yeah.
Alex, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. Best of luck with the run in Enniskillen, and really looking forward to seeing that bowler hat that you're going to dust off from your student days and get on to your head at this point in time. Thanks for being with us this evening, Alex.
Thank you so much.
That's
lovely to talk to you. Thank you
too. That's Alex Jennings. And Oh My God, takes place over two weekends, the 12th and 13th of April, and the 18th and 19th of April in Enniskillen. And that will be celebrating the birthday of Samuel Beckett, which was on Good Friday back when he was born. I believe it was Friday the 13th, a Good Friday at that particular year. Alex Jennings appears in a performed reading of Waiting for Godot at 3 p.m. on the 18th and 19th of April, which is this year's Good Friday. There's a bit of a meta for you. Tickets are free, but they must be booked in advance at eventbrite.ie. Lafcadio O'Hearn was an extraordinary literary figure in the 19th century, an Irish-Greek writer who became Japan's most celebrated interpreter of folklore and ghost stories. He was born in Greece to an Irish father and a Greek mother, spent his early years in Dublin and Waterford, where he was immersed in Ireland's rich storytelling traditions. Now, he left Ireland as a child, but the folktales and supernatural beliefs of his homeland remained deeply ingrained in his imagination. He arrived in Japan in 1890, fully embraced its culture, married a Japanese woman and became known as Kozumi Yakumo. Now, more than a century after his death, Hearn's legacy is being explored in an exhibition, Kwaidan, Encounters with Lafcadio O'Hearn. Co-curator and artist Stephen Lawler and Paul Murray, one of the leading experts on Hearn, spoke to Kay Sheehy last week about Hearn's enduring influence, the ways in which his ghostly tales have been reimagined through contemporary art. Kay first asked Paul Murray about Hearn's Irish heritage and the fact that he wasn't actually born in Ireland.
No, he was born in Lefkada, or Lefkas in Greece, in 1850. And he spent 2 years there. And then he was brought to Ireland as a two-year-old child by his mother. And they lived with the Hearn family. And his father, who was an Irish Army officer, didn't come back with them. He went on to pursue his military career. Now, his mother, Rosa, was a Greek lady. She wasn't very happy in Ireland. And she went back to Greece in 1854 when he was four, and he never saw her again. And both of his parents divorced and remarried. So he was brought up by an elderly great aunt here in Dublin, a Mrs. Brennan, who lived at 73 Upper Leeson Street. And that's where Hearn spent most of his childhood in Ireland. He was there until the age of 13.
What a sad, abandoned childhood he had.
Yes, it was incredible. He was obviously very emotionally deprived, even though he was brought up in great luxury, surrounded by servants and all the trappings of wealth. But he never forgot his mother, and he always had this sort of idealization of the mother figure. But yes, it was very sad, and I think that's why, as a child, he was haunted by ghosts and demons and believed that he suffered visitations from ghouls that had the power not just to terrify you, but to kill you if necessary. So, yes, it was kind of a little Lord Fauntleroy, you know, very privileged on one hand and emotionally deprived on the other.
And how much would it have been the servants who worked in the houses that he was brought up in would have fed him these stories as well, like the Irish?
Yes, it would have been the servants. And he tells us that himself, that he had a Connacht nurse who told him fairy tales and ghost stories. And what happened as well was there was a great library in the house, which was full of Gothic literature, some of it, you know, blazingly anti-Catholic, even though Mrs. Brennan was officially a Catholic convert. So he was able to read these books at an age when he was far too young to read them. So he was imbibing all this literary horror. At the same time, the servants were telling him all these horrific folk tales from Irish folklore. And so the two kind of combined in his head and gave him the most horrific nightmares that he wrote about later on in his later years in Japan. So we know that the roots of this horror are here in Dublin.
So a Quaidan then, Stephen, which is your exhibition. And this is, what does Quaidan mean?
Quaidan is, I think it's simply ghost stories, in fact. And there are 19 stories in Quaidan, and there are, of them, the majority are Japanese. But there are a few Irish stories in there as well.
And these are all written by Lafcadio?
All written by Lafcadio, but some of them are Japanese folklore and based on true events in Japan. And he just rewrites them in his beautiful prose to sort of, you know, to make them so pleasant to read.
A little like Lady Gregory did with folk tales in Ireland, maybe.
I think perhaps he had more input than she would have. He wasn't interpreting. He was actually rewriting the stories.
And it gives a sense of, you know, those ghoulish stories that Paul was talking about.
Well, there are 40 artists in the exhibition and we let them choose freely. So of the 19 stories, six chose one called Mujina, which is about a faceless woman. And you know, Japanese humour, or the difference in their attitude to humour or horror or all those other things, is kind of, we scratch our head a little bit. So I've often wondered how anybody could be afraid of a faceless person. What can they do to you? Sure, they can't even see you. And so six artists chose that one. Hoichi the Earless is the longest story in the book and a fantastic story.
Somebody with no ears.
The guy with no ears. He has his ears torn off his head by a samurai who brings the ears back to his master to prove that he found this this musician, a blind monk, a biwa player. And that one relates directly to Japanese history, where the Battle of Danura and a whole clan is wiped out, including a six-year-old emperor.
Now, we'll come back to more stories in a second, Stephen. So how did he get to Japan? I mean, he went around the world before he went to Japan, didn't he, Paul?
He did, yeah. He left, he went to boarding school in England in his teens, and then his aunt lost her money, and at 19 he went to America penniless. But he became an American success story, and within a few years of arriving, he becomes a journalist, becomes a very celebrated journalist in America. Initially in Cincinnati, then in New Orleans, which he loved. Then he in his late 30s, he goes to the West Indies, spends 2 years there. And then he comes back to America again. He's at a loose end. And so Harper, the publisher, suggested he might go on an assignment to Japan, which he does. Being Hearn, he has a bus stop with Harper as soon as he gets to Japan. And then he's kind of becalmed. He gets a job, first of all, as a teacher, and then later on as a university professor. And that's how he spends the last 14 years of his life in Japan.
And did he find it easy to master the language and get, you know, it wasn't a notoriously closed society, Japan, even at that stage?
Well, it was opening up in the Meiji era. But no, he never mastered Japanese. His Japanese remained poor. And his wife, who spoke no English, how they communicated is a bit of a mystery. But she was the one who interpreted the folk tales for him. And he would get her to tell him the stories over and over again, to a point where he imagined he himself was in the story. And it was through that medium that he wrote all these wonderful Kaidan.
Oh, right. So he kind of dived into it and became almost part of it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, his wife told stories that when he was writing Hoichi the Earless, for example, she called out to him, you know, Hoichi, Hoichi. And he said, yes, I am Hoichi the Blind Man. And he was so in character that he actually believed he was this Hoichi person of the story.
Now, going back to your exhibition, Stephen, so you have both Irish and Japanese artists interpreting the ghost stories of Lafcadio Hearn. Was there a big difference in how they interpreted these stories?
Absolutely. There's a huge difference. Every single Japanese person knows who Lafcadio Hearn is. And that's the reason we began this project. And I've met people like Paul, who great people to work with. Their knowledge of Hearn and their love of Hearn is fantastic and has been a great support to us. But the Japanese, so they know from their childhood what those stories, they know them inside out. And their love of things like the cherry blossom, there are a few cherry blossom stories in there, you know, are reflected in the exhibition when you go to see it. The Irish artists, everything is new to all of them. And they find Hearn and the stories, you know, reflected in a little bit of a more contemporary way, I think, than the Japanese ones, and far less strange, let's put it that way. So the good part was that they were ghost stories. And I think not one of the artists we asked objected or refused to take part. Everyone was so enthusiastic to find out not only about these fantastic stories, some of them are 3 or 4 pages, but really inspiring. They're almost visual to read them. A picture comes to mind immediately. So therefore, there's no end of a selection or choice within the stories to depict.
But Paul, Stephen's saying there how celebrated he still is throughout Japan. How did that happen?
Well, I think what happened was, first of all, when he was alive, he was really writing for a Western, largely American audience. And then he died in 1904. From about the 1920s onwards, his stories started being translated back into Japanese. And he became then a national figure in Japan, and indeed has been on the school curriculum. And he also played a leading role in preserving a lot of that folklore, because at the time he was alive, the Japanese were throwing out a lot of the traditional folklore because they were embracing Westernism, everything that was new. So Hearn functioned both as for them as a great writer, but also as a man who had helped to preserve their heritage.
And the fact that he couldn't speak Japanese or never learn Japanese, was that a big impediment to him?
I don't think so, because I think Hearn's genius, as Stephen was saying, is the fact he wrote so beautifully in English. It's the same thing, there's a certain amount of doubt as to how good he was in French, but he also translated marvellously from the French when he was in the United States. So I think the thing that people miss is Hearn's a very practical guy, like a lot of writers. And what he would do, for example, is he'd get all his students to write essays on a particular theme. He would then take that material and craft it into published material himself. So he's a very practical guy whose genius was not foreign languages, but essentially recasting very often primary research done by other people into masterful English prose.
Stephen, the exhibition obviously celebrates the stories through visual arts. What does it do then for his literary heritage? How engaged can people get with the stories themselves?
I think it's a fantastic introduction to his work, Kaidan, because it's simple. I'm not sure if it's written for children, but children love these stories. Most adults in Japan have read them anyway as children. So they are kind of part of the folklore. But I do think as an introduction for most people to Hearn, I went to Japan with a show based on the work of Yeats, 5 Irish writers and 15 visual artists. So we started in Sligo to Dublin, to London, to Beijing, and on then to Tokyo. And that's where somebody said to me, oh, you're Irish, you must know who Lafcadio Hearn is. I said, never heard of him. I didn't actually believe such a person could exist, because his story is quite unlikely. It sounds as if somebody made it up. But the more you read about him and the more you read the stories and dig a bit deeper into the variety of novels plus descriptive books he's written about Japan, they are just wonderful. Wonderfully written and as fresh today as they were when they were written back at the beginning of the 20th century.
And Paul, did he ever come home?
No. The closest he ever came, towards the end of his time in Japan, he was communicating with, first of all, Cornell University, United States. They invited him to come and give some lectures, but illness on the campus prevented that. He was also corresponding with the Japan Society in London, and they were interested in him coming and giving some lectures under their auspices. But again, that never happened because his health declined. And as I say, he died relatively young at the age of 54. But he certainly had ideas of, say, going either to the United States or to Europe, but it never happened.
And Stephen, you're taking the work to Japan.
Yes, we actually have 7 or 8 venues in Japan. We've opened in 6 of them so far, and we're opening at Osaka Expo at the Irish Pavilion this month, which is wonderful because he is sort of the embodiment of the cultural connection between Ireland and Japan. And as most Japanese people, as I say, all Japanese people know who he is, they immediately want to engage and see what it's about. So
it'd be a great attraction for Ireland at Expo as well as for your own exhibition.
Exactly, because, you know, as I said, culturally, you know, there isn't any better, I think, person to join the two cultures.
Well, the best of luck with your exhibition at Osaka. My thanks to Stephen Lawler and to Paul Murray. Quaidan, Encounters with Lafcadio Hearn runs at Farmley Gallery in Dublin's Phoenix Park until Sunday, the 24th of August. Further details can be found at quaidanexhibition.com and at farmley.ie.
It's been 3 decades since Muriel's Wedding first burst onto cinema screens in a blaze of sequins, ABBA and emotional chaos. What began as a modest Australian indie film quickly became a cult classic, then a cultural touchstone for awkward outsiders, complicated women and anyone who's ever dreamed of escaping their small town and becoming someone else. The film had themes of female friendship, identity, social pressure and the subversion of the traditional wedding fantasy. It also featured Toni Collette's star-making turn during the glitter-drenched rise of 90s Australian cinema that included films like Strictly Ballroom and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. The film Mark has its 30th anniversary this year. It's Pearl wedding anniversary, as it were. I went looking that up for Muriel and for a slightly disastrous wedding, it has to be said. In hindsight, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the film. It was part, Jen Gannon is with me in studio to talk more about Muriel's Wedding. I'm not surprised, Jen, that you, I'm guessing, have watched this film from start to finish many times over.
Many, many, many times.
Once a year on each anniversary.
Probably even more. As a complicated woman myself who is terrible, just like Muriel is, I think there is that huge understanding for its audience. And like when it came out, it was, you know, 6 years before I think Bridget Jones burst onto the screen as well. So you're
and
talking about.
You can kind of see the precursor of that in
you
some
kinda
ways.
You kind of can.
It's
a lot weirder and a lot wilder than Bridget, but it does express the kind of same frustrations and the dangers of having, you know, the conventional life as your goal through the character of Muriel in a very different, very technical or very signature. Now we think signature Australian way, but back then I think we were all very surprised about what it was showing us on screen.
How different was it from what we would have considered classic Australian film of that time?
I suppose
previous to that time, because it created the whole new sense of this indie Aussie type of film which could be made on a shoestring and didn't have to have stars all over it. Come out of it.
There was like this kind of, you had George Miller's Mad Max, which was like, you know, this crazy kind of futurism and very surreal. So you're used to maybe that world, or Peter Weir's classic, you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock and the kind of beauty of that. But I think the thing about Muriel's Wedding is we were kind of primed for its weird sense of humour through our love of Australian soaps in the 80s and 90s, because yes, Australian Italian soaps could be very generic, as we all know. But at the same time, like Neighbours had this very weird episode where you went into Bouncer's head, the dog. Bouncer had a dream and it was this whole episode. And then he had something in Home and Away, like Bobby died in Home and Away and then she came back to Ailsa as a ghost through a fridge.
Yeah.
So the Australian sense of humour is offbeat. And I think that kind of fired people up in the notion of responding to Muriel's Wedding in the way they did. So it is part of this new wave of Australian cinema that came in the mid-90s. And they call it the glitter cycle because it's camp, it's kitsch, it's fun. It's Baz Luhrmann's Strictly Ballroom, which just came out of the traps. It felt like out of nowhere in 1992 and was, you know, this rough and ready, but also quite glamorous piece about ballroom dancing. Then you had the absolutely, I can't talk about it enough, a few months, I think, prior to Muriel's Wedding was Stephen Elliott's towering, brilliant The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which is about three beleaguered drag queens who take off in this bus into the middle of the desert, basically. And you had Guy Pearce, you had Terence Stamp, 60s heartthrob Terence Stamp as this, you know, really angry drag queen. But you also had this story about Australia's, you know, LGBTQ community that were out there and very strong. And but it was really creative looking. It looked like nothing else you'd see on the screen. And that, I also think, is wired throughout the visuals of Muriel's Wedding too.
Yeah, there is that kind of camp feel certainly to the ABBA part of it. And we'll come to ABBA's role within the film in a moment. None of those films or television series. I mean, Ramsay Street is just Ramsay Street. Porpoise Spit, you just don't want to live there, do you?
No.
You know, even if you've never been there. This is Muriel's hometown. And where does Muriel not fit in, it has to be said, to Porpoise Spit?
I mean, it is one of those classic small towns, suburbs where, you know, everybody, there was the crowds of girls that she desperately kind of wants to be
horrible
friends with.
Friends.
They're
well,
the kind of
the queen bee type.
The mean girls who peaked in high school and never got beyond that, but still think they're the centre of their own universe. They desperately want to ditch Muriel. She's really embarrassing to them because, you know, she's not gym honed. She doesn't have the wardrobe that they have. She's not into the music. Like, she's, you know, ABBA at that time, in the 90s at that time, weren't seen as what they are now. So she, it doesn't fit in at all with them. And she just feels lonely and she feels like she's not seen. And especially at home, her father is like this terrible, crooked politician and he rules the roost. And all he cares about is, you know, succeeding in life in any way possible, but also just denigrating his wife and kids.
Oh, yeah, it's so
and,
sad, that relationship.
Yeah. Like
that particular marital relationship.
Yeah, his wife, Betty, is literally just addicted to, you know, painkillers and sleeping tablets because she wants to keep in this almost comatose state because she's dealing with this overbearing father. And that's one of the reasons why Muriel wants to escape as well.
Yeah, well, you can understand why she wants to get out of her family situation. You can also understand why she might want to get out of her, in inverted commas, friends situations. Tanya, Chelsea, is it, or Chesley? Jamie, Janie and Nicole. I mean, they are just monstrous. And here they are letting Muriel, Toni Collette, know that they are monstrous and that they don't want her next nor near them.
Muriel, people think we're mad, but that's just us. We're ragers. People invite us to parties and they know we'll just have a good time. We're mad. Party, party, party. That's our image. You know what I mean. We're mad. We don't want you hanging around us anymore.
I didn't steal the dress. It was a mistake.
It's not the dress. It's you. We've told you 1,000 times how to do your hair, but you never listen. You never wear the right clothes. You're fat. You listen to 70s music. This is the 90s. We all listen to the Baby Animals.
And Nirvana.
You bring us down, Muriel.
You embarrass us.
I know I'm not normal, but I'm trying to change. I'm trying to become more like you, more of a...
It's too late.
I can change.
You'll still be you.
There's just something so sad about even you, when you hear Toni Collette as Muriel there in Muriel's Wedding, trying desperately to fit in with a group of people she should just get miles away from as quickly as possible.
Exactly. But in a small
Jen
town,
Gannon with us this evening celebrating 30 years of the Australian film Muriel's
in a small
Wedding.
Town, she just feels like she's never going to escape that, and they're the only ones around her. But they also have very sad lives as well. They're not these, you know, gleaming you know, beacons of hope or anything.
No, and the worst makeup in the world.
Some dodgy makeup going on, I will have to say. But like, you know, they're stuck in loveless marriages as And marriage is the only goal. And this film is a lot about like those conventions, those societal conventions that women especially find themselves in and what to do. They think there's freedom in this, but is there freedom or is it actually trapping them into a life that they don't want to lead? But is it about the courage to kind of let these things go and move on and move forward? Is that what the goal is, should be?
There's only one way out of porpoise spit. And it's this way. You know, I could watch that sequence over and over again from Muriel's Wedding. It has Toni Collette, not singing, but they're miming herself and what's her name?
Rachel
Griffiths, who plays the character of Rhonda, doing this wonderfully overdressed version of it to those bad women, those mean girls who are their friends. And we do have to talk about that core relationship, which is between the Rachel Griffiths character of Rhonda and Toni Collette's character of Muriel.
Yeah, Muriel heads off on her own on a holiday with the other girls are going on their cruise. She's not invited. She decides to nick some of her dad's money and head off and do it herself. And there she bumps into Rhonda, who's played by Rachel Griffiths, and she is another ex kind of porpoise spit survivor who also was treated badly by those girls. And the two kind of team up, and through this kind of connection, this love that Muriel has of ABBA, ABBA for her is like her escapism. It's about glamour. It's about innocence, about, you know, leaving it all on the dance floor and being able to be someone else and someone new. And Rhonda kind of sees that in her, and she's the kind of friend that just gives her that little bit of a push into trying to be somebody else and be the other person, the best version of herself.
I often think that in lesser hands, both the character of Muriel and the character of Rhonda, as played by Rachel Griffiths, just would have been disastrous. Rhonda in particular, you know, who ends up in a wheelchair and who then gets this awful cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, that could have just become, you know, Schmaltz City.
It could be Beaches level. But like PJ Hogan, who's such a smart, incisive and writer, he wrote the film as well. He makes sure not to balance this out or look at Rhonda as some kind of angelic figure once she gets the cancer diagnosis or once she has the struggle of being in the wheelchair. She's still as vivacious and full of life as ever, but also someone who's mischievous and completely sex positive and is youthful and out for everything in life, like just wants to live her life on her terms. And what you instead see is some, like with Muriel, kind of pulls away because she still wants to have that conventional life. She's obsessed with getting married and will do it at any means possible. And when there's a kind of schism between the two girls and you see that Rhonda's only option, she's been offered this independence through her relationship with Muriel, but you can see that's actually hanging on the line and she might have to go back to Porpoise Spit with her mother. Depending on your friendships.
Here's the scene
too.
between Toni Collette and Rachel Griffiths where they're discussing that idea, well, not discussing, where Rhonda is making it absolutely clear she does not want to go back to Porpoise Spit.
How can you stand this? You push me around in this chair, you cook for me, you even help me dress. I hate it.
When I lived in Porpoise Spit, I'd just stay in my room for hours and listen to ABBA songs. Sometimes I'd stay in there all day. Since I've met you and moved to Sydney, I haven't listened to one ABBA song. It's because now my life's as good as an ABBA song. It's as good as Dancing Queen.
Come off it. Promise me something. We never go back there.
What do you mean?
I mean, I can't go back and live in Porpoise Spit with Mum. Not in a wheelchair, not with her.
You're gonna walk.
Promise we never go back.
I promise.
Toni Collette as Muriel, Rachel Griffiths as Rhonda in a scene there from Muriel's Wedding. Toni Collette, I mean, I don't know how well known she was in Australia prior to Muriel's Wedding, but this launched her into a stratospheric career, really.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell, like, the complicated nature. Like, as you said, if in the wrong hands, this could have been a straight down the line parody almost, but she really feels
no histrionics. That's what's so impressive about her.
And there's an innocence to her and a guilelessness that is so endearing and so warm, but also, and you do kind of want to look after her, but also you see yourself in her too, because there's a massive vulnerability within her. Like, there is a scene, and it can flip from laugh out loud comedy to absolute, you know, emotion. Like, there's a scene where she is sliding down the wall in a wedding dress shop because she's going in trying on all these wedding dresses all the time,
she ends up marrying this Olympic swimmer who kind of ends up kind of half falling for her.
He does,
beautiful
she,
Adonis
he,
of a man.
She wins him over, and that's the thing. And she does it in a way that the greatest thing about Muriel's Wedding in a way is that she doesn't change physically. She's not put through this Hollywood makeover machine and is glammed up or anything. She's just herself till the end.
You mentioned
it's attractive then.
You mentioned Bridget Jones there. What other sort of films do you think that have come out of Muriel's Wedding, and also what other characters have come out of Toni Collette's performance? Because it was a new type of woman, I think, that she showed us.
As I said, like, that vulnerability, that scene where she's sliding down the wall, and, you know, after this massively comic moment where she starts to cry in the wedding dress shop and she says, why can't it be me? Why can't it be me? And that was something I think struck a lot of women, like, that, you know, you're living outside maybe what the social norms are saying about you, maybe physically or the way that you live your life, and it was something very different. And I think that's echoed through a lot of cinema. Bridesmaids, something like Lena Dunham's Girls, I think there's, you know, there would be no Girls, I think, without Toni Collette's performance here
and
in
Rachel
Muriel's
Griffiths
Wedding.
Too, Rachel Griffiths is an absolute star, and she was a big, I suppose she went on to the
Six
big
Feet
thing,
Under,
Six Feet Under was the big
Brenda
thing,
yeah, which I think is one of the most important female characters on TV ever, and she
all
did
right.
it so well.
Happy Pearl Wedding Anniversary, Muriel's Wedding. Jen Gannon speaking to us about the film, which is in selected cinemas around the country to mark its 30th anniversary. Bring your sequins and your ABBA outfits, I would guess, would be de rigueur if you're going to that. I asked you to complete the title of Brian Friedel's 1990 play Dancing at Lunasa, and it had to be spelled L-U-G-H-N-A-S-A to win the tickets to Making History at the Everyman in Cork and the overnight stay at the Metropole Hotel in the heart of the city. Anne Scallon is tonight's winner. Congratulations to you, Anne, and hope that you enjoy that night out. There, as usual now, first night back, can't find the name of anybody in the credits, so here goes. Will I remember the people sitting outside? I do hope I do. Mark McGrath is on sound this evening. Clap, clap, clap. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Liam Murphy was the researcher, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night, God willing, at 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.